All right, so there's no reading for this evening, and our first speaker is our brother Jesse. So without any further ado, brother Jesse. Put this bad boy on here. Should be all right there. Should people just whack in your pocket or something?
All right. Thanks everybody for coming out today. So today we are going to have a look at Genesis chapter 17 and Genesis chapter 18. I'm going to look at Genesis 17 and Eden's going to do Genesis chapter 18. So can anybody remember what you did last class? Just shout out. Nothing. It must have been an amazing class. All right, well, Zach and Matt both sent me a couple of points. So Zach said that God has a time frame in which he will work things, and we can't go do it by our own might. He said that we've got to remember the importance of realizing that God is our shield and our reward. Abraham's belief in God, in what God promised, was accounted to him as being righteous. The question then was, how strong is our faith? Matt said that Sarah, like Sarah, we all have points in our lives where we run out of patience. We need to involve God in our decision. Gossip is dangerous. We are commanded to treat people as we would have them treat us. And don't be disillusioned when people do ungodly things, because godliness comes from God, so try and be like him. All right, so that's pretty horrible writing. But that is a brief chapter breakup of chapter 17. I've got it over here. If you want it, come see me after. It's from Uncle John Martin, so it's pretty good. It's not mine, so just remember that. All right, so we're going to have a look at the title of God. So at the end of Genesis 16, verse 16, it says, "And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram." And then at the beginning of Genesis chapter 17, it says when Abram was 90 years and 9. So when he was 99. So there's this period of 13 years in between these two chapters. So Abraham and Sarai, I had to wait 13 years more for the fulfillment of the promise, on top of the time they had already been waiting. One of the main lessons we got out of chapter 16 was that Abram and Sarai needed to learn to wait on God. They decided to take matters into their own hands and not to rely on God to fulfill what he had promised. So Romans 4, which is basically the commentary on this, tells us that Abraham and Sarah had dead bodies. They could not produce children. It says, "I have made you a father of many nations in the presence of God in whom he believed, who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist." So what didn't exist for Abraham and Sarai? Their child. They didn't have this promised seed. They could not produce children, and so therefore, in this 13-year time period, they would have realized that it was nothing that they could do by themselves. Their own bodies could not do it, and so they could not raise this seed. But it required divine intervention from God, and that was the only way that they were going to have a seed. So in Genesis 17, verse 1, it says, "The Lord appeared to Abram. So we're going to have a look at, if you have a look at page 46 of your study week notes, under the section, the name of God, it says, "The names of God may confuse us, but a simple understanding can have a huge impact on the story we are reading. The flow chart helps keep it simple." So they said there's two things to remember when looking at the title of God. The meaning is always telling us something, and the context is essential to understand. So, what we're going to have a look at is a few times the title El Shaddai is used in the rest of the Bible. So, El means strength or might, and Shaddai has the idea of nourishing or to destroy. So if you turn with me to Genesis chapter 28, we'll have a look at one of these occurrences. Genesis chapter 28 and verse 3. And God Almighty, or El Shaddai, bless thee and make thee fruitful and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people. So, the context in this section is God is involved in the creation of families, okay? The multiplication of offspring. So keep that in mind. Come to Genesis chapter 49. And verse 25, it says, even by the God of thy father, so the God there is the Ael, who shall help thee, and by the Almighty, which is the Shaddai, who shall bless thee with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lieth under, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. So what's the context of this one? It's in the sense of someone nursing a family, a mother nursing a child, or the idea of a nourisher. And finally, if you come to 2 Corinthians 6, and verse 17 and 18, it says, wherefore come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith El Shaddai. So what's the context here? It says, if you come to me, I'll be your father. You'll be my sons and my daughters. Okay. So keeping this in mind, if we come back to Genesis chapter 17, with all this about El Shaddai, what does it mean? It's God as a nursing father of a new family. The God to a miraculous son. It is the beginning of a nation. So what does God mean when he says, walk before me and be perfect? So obviously Abram couldn't be perfect. We can't be perfect either. What God is actually saying, if you have a look at your little margin there, number 4, it says, upright or sincere. So Abram's told to be upright and sincere. So who else was upright and sincere earlier in the record of Genesis? Who is it? Yes. Who? Yes, Noah. What did Noah do? In a world of sinners, he was the only righteous man, right? Okay, so Noah was perfect in the eyes of God. He walked in this upright way. So what did God do with Noah? God made a new beginning with his sons after the flood. Okay, so he destroyed the earth and Noah was left with his family. So what's the link between Noah and Abraham? God was going to do the same thing with Abraham and Sarah. He was going to create a new beginning, okay? A new beginning through this promise. So the idea of walking with God is carried out throughout a lot of the Bible. In the notes, there's a few verses. I'll just read them out for you. In Micah 6, verse 8, he says, he hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly before thy God. So some of these aspects of walking before God are doing justly, loving mercy, and walking humbly. Now one of the main ones is Romans 4, verse 11 to 12, which is this section dedicated to Abraham. And it says, and he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had, yet being uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all them that believe, though they be not circumcised, that righteousness might be imputed unto them also, and the father of circumcision to them who are not of the circumcision only, but who also walk in the steps of that faith of our father Abraham, which he had, being yet uncircumcised. So this righteousness that was imputed to Abraham can be passed on. So it sounds like a good thing, but what does it actually mean? So was Abram righteous? Yep. How? Who? Where? Where is it told? Right, so it's Genesis 15, verse 6. Yep, exactly. And so that's talking about in Genesis 15, verse 6, where God says, look up at the stars if you can count them. That's what you, the number of your seed. And because Abram believed, it was accounted to him for righteousness. So he definitely was righteous. But how then can this be attributed to us? Abram was righteous because of his belief. So then if God is prepared to look at us as being a righteous man or a righteous woman, then what is your response? Think about it. If God is prepared to look at you as an upright and sincere person, what is your response? It's pretty serious because it puts a responsibility on us. Okay, we have to respond to the call and not just respond and then just leave it. It's a whole lifestyle. You have to be so thankful for everything that we have. And that's the way that you could be walking perfect with God. Okay, and finally the Galatians 5, which is, as everybody knows, the fruits of the Spirit. I'll just read that, verse 22 to 25. It says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. And they that are Christ's have crucified the flesh with the affection of lusts. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. So all of these are these aspects that Abram needed to work on to be able to walk and be upright and sincere. He needed all of these. It was a culmination of all these things that we looked at in Micah 6, in Romans 4, and in Galatians. He needed to crucify the flesh and apply the aspects of these fruits of the Spirit. Okay, so Abram's name changes. I'm not going to speak too much about it because I'm not 100% sure on all the stuff about it, but Abram meant lofty father, okay? And with the additional H to his name, it changed to Abraham, the father of a multitude. So the changing of the name is obviously significant because it directly related to the promises of the covenant that had been made, that God had made with Abram. So as we've seen in the last few classes, it involved a seed and a nation. And the changing of the name speaks of the promise being shared to these other nations as an everlasting covenant. This is mentioned in Galatians 3, verse 7, verse 8, verse 16, verse 27 to 29, Romans 4, verse 16 to 17, Romans 9, verse 6 to 8. They all talk about the changing of the name and this promise extending to a nation. Okay, so that was Abraham's changing the name. And then in Genesis 17, verse 16, it says, and I will bless her and give thee a son unto her. Verse 15, and for Sarai thy wife, thou shalt no longer call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her and give thee a son also of her. Yea, I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be of her. So Sarah's name means princess. And her name is also changed because she's going to be involved in the process of bringing this nation. She was going to be the mother of the great nation. And it's a process that involved both Abraham and Sarah. So it's not just Abram, it's both of them together. And that's really important. It's them working together. And though they were old, God was going to work with them to produce a royal seed. So the agency is all with God and not with man. The other thing I wasn't so sure about is about the numbers involved. People talk about the numbers, and apparently H is the fifth number, which in the Bible speaks of divine grace. So that's obviously present in Abraham's life. If they couldn't have a child, all these things that God has done is obviously divine grace being present. But take that for what you will. People really go on about it, but I'm not sure. So obviously the changing of the names was a big deal. It didn't just affect Abraham and Sarah, but it was to affect their seed, which they didn't yet have. Okay, so what's a covenant? Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Anything else? That's fine. So I had an agreement which brings about a relationship of commitment between God and his people. So two parties involved, and it's a commitment, okay? It's not something that's taken lightly. It is like a contract. It's a binding thing. It's a pledge with the root idea is to cut a covenant. So where an animal would be cut under the law, an animal would be cut and they'd be separated and both parties would walk through, and that's like the handshake deal. Like this is locked in. This is actually going to happen. So what was the first covenant in the Bible? Yep. Yeah, that too. I actually didn't think of that. That's probably the biggest one. But maybe what's the second one? Yeah, with Noah. So God destroyed the earth. Well, I didn't think of Genesis, too. Yeah, it's only a small one, yeah. God destroyed the earth, and then he promised, he made a covenant that he would never destroy it again. So the covenant had already been cut in Genesis chapter 15, as the boys looked at last week. And so this is the third time that covenant's mentioned. And in Genesis chapter 17, it's mentioned 13 times. So it's obviously pretty important. It's in verse 2, verse 4, twice in verse 7, in verse 9, in verse 10, in verse 11, twice in verse 13, in verse 14, in verse 19 twice, and in verse 21. So it's obviously a really important thing if the word had hardly been used before, and then... Yep. Yeah. No, that's fine. Okay. I think the pen's a little bit broken. Okay, so it's in verse 2, verse 4, twice in verse 7, in verse 9, in verse 10, in verse 11, twice in verse 13, in verse 14, twice in verse 19, and finally in verse 21. Is that readable? That's all right. Okay, so yeah, if it's used this many times and it's a phrase that has barely been used, it's obviously important. So why does God make covenants? Anybody got any ideas? Just throw out suggestions. Why would God make a pact like this? Yep. Yep. Yeah. Definitely. Yep. Anything else?
Makes you remember something.
Yeah. Definitely. And that's really important, as you say in the rest of the chapter. Yeah, it's a binding thing. Both people get stuff out of it. And it's really God looking out for us, looking out for Abraham. So he'd already had the covenant, but this time he's talking about the token of the covenant. So we're just going to throw out some questions from the notes on page 49 so you can fill these ones in. So who was the covenant between? God and Abraham, yep. Fill that in if you haven't already. What was going to happen to Abraham, to Abram? Yep. Have you already got it filled out, Liv? Oh, too good. He's going to be a father of many nations, is what Liv said. So who else was the covenant with? His seed, yep, Abram's seed. In Genesis 17, verse 8, God says, I will be their God. What is he promising? Yeah, absolutely. Yep, so that God will look after him. You'll be part of his family. Okay? How will the covenant be linked between Abram and those who followed after him? Yeah, but what was the process? Yep, circumcision. So every man child would be circumcised. And what would happen if they didn't obey? In Genesis 17, verse 14. Yep, absolutely. You'd be cut off. It says, and the uncircumcised man child whose flesh of his foreskin is not circumcised, that soul shall be cut off from his people. He hath broken my covenant. Okay, so this idea of the token of the covenant. The token was to be in the flesh of Abraham and his seed. And as Ryan just said, if you didn't have this, you were cut off from his people. Circumcision was to be a physical reminder to the descendants of Abraham about the covenant that they had made. It says, to thee and thy seed shall be for an everlasting covenant. In verse 11 and 12 and 13 of Genesis chapter 17, here's the order, and it says, and he that is born in thine house, and he that is bought with money, verse 12, and he that is 8 days old shall be circumcised among you, every man child in your generations. He that is born in the house or bought with money of any stranger, which is not of thy seed, he that is born in thy house and he that is bought with money must needs be circumcised, and my covenant shall be in your flesh. So it's God's covenant. If you look at the end there, it's God's covenant in their flesh. Okay? So everybody in Abraham's house was to be circumcised. And if they weren't, they were to be cut off. And in classic Abraham style, what does he do? He goes right ahead and does it. He just goes and in verse 22, and he left off taking with him and talking with him, and God went up from Abram, and Abram took his son, everybody that was bought with money, and on the selfsame day, and circumcised them, okay? So Abraham was this man of action, as we've seen. God tells him to do something, and he's like, bam, all right, I'm going to go do it. And this is the same thing. This important token, he's like, all right, this is serious, I'm going to do it, and he does it. So then, if a man was circumcised, was he automatically accounted as righteous and access to the promise? No. No, he wasn't. Was Abraham circumcised when he was accounted as being righteous? No, exactly. As we saw in Romans 4, verse 11 and 12, Abram was accounted as being righteous before this had happened. So he was not yet circumcised. And Elpis Israel says, an everlasting possession, it can only be obtained by belief of the things promised in the covenant being counted to them for righteousness in the way of God's appointment. So the act of circumcision could not save someone. So what does God actually want? God requires circumcision of the heart. That's what he wanted to see. The circumcision of the flesh was to be the outward sign of a circumcised heart. Okay, so come to Deuteronomy 10. Deuteronomy 10 and verse 16, it says, "Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart and be no more stiff-necked." So the people being stiff-necked, and so God's like, you've got to circumcise your heart, okay? We'll just go through these quickly. Deuteronomy 30 verse 6. "And the Lord thy God will circumcise thine heart, the heart of thy seed, to love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul, that thou mayest livest." So in order to live, what happened? They needed to have their heart circumcised. And in Jeremiah 4 verse 4, we won't go there. It says, it basically says, if you don't circumcise your heart, you'll feel my wrath. And it'll burn you. You'll be quenched with fire and nobody else will be able to quench it. And the final thing we want to look at is in Romans 2, verse 28 and 29. If we have a look there. "For he is not a Jew which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God." So Paul says you can't just be a Jew externally, you are a Jew within. You can't just have one without the other. And the same is this with this circumcision. He talks about the law, the letter there, in verse 29 is the law. In Galatians 5 verse 3 it says, "To every man that is circumcised, that he is a debtor to the whole law." So if you were circumcised, you had this responsibility. Could you keep the law? Could anybody keep the law? No, you couldn't keep the law. In Romans 7, I think it says that the law was weak through the flesh and only gave knowledge of sin. So it made the people aware that there was a problem, where the problem lied, which was in the flesh, and that they could do nothing of themselves to save them. They needed saving from somebody else. This token was not a means of obtaining perfection, as the Jews taught, but it was God's sign. In Genesis 17, verse 13, it says, "A token of my covenant in your flesh." The mark of God's covenant was a reminder to the seed of Abraham that this was not something they could earn by the workings of the flesh. The law could not give someone the right to live forever. So then where does our hope lie? In Galatians 2, it says, "I do not frustrate the grace of God, for if righteousness come by the law, then Christ is dead in vain." So if the law could make someone right and upright in God's eyes, then Jesus died in vain. So obviously this whole process pointed to the necessity of Christ. So how do we circumcise our hearts today? Baptism, exactly. So by putting on Christ and putting to death the flesh, baptism is our process of being connected to this promise. So the big question for us is, are we just external disciples of Christ, like the Pharisees that stood on the street corner, or have our hearts been circumcised? It needs to be both inward and outward, as Paul said. In Elpis Israel, it says, "True circumcision is of the heart. Circumcision of the flesh is but an outward sign of Abraham's circumcision of the heart. And everyone who would inherit with Abraham must be circumcised of the heart. When Abraham was circumcised of heart, his faith in God was imputed to him for righteousness."
All right. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Thanks, Tom. Good evening. How are we all? I hope you guys are full because me, Jesse, and Dave certainly aren't. You guys ate it all before we got there. All right, so I'm basically going to be drawing some thoughts for the study week out of Genesis chapter 18. Now, if you're doing your daily readings and stuff, Genesis 18 is one of those classic chapters where it's a bit more of a story than like themes and deepness. So unlucky for me, I didn't get the whole covenant with Jesse that he can go into great depth. So it's going to be pretty cruisy, pretty easy. And hopefully from tonight, you'll be able to get just some points that you can discuss with your groups, your discussion groups, maybe throw out some things with them. Maybe just highlight a couple of points. We'll try and keep it fairly simple tonight. Don't worry, I won't be using the whiteboard too much. So if you're at home listening, you don't need to worry that much. So who has their study week notes here? Quite a few people. Good for you guys. Well done. All right, so just so you know, the section that we're going to be dealing with will be pages 53 to 61. That covers pretty much all of Genesis chapter 18. Now, unfortunately for me, it's a massive chapter and a lot goes on to in it, so I probably won't be able to cover it all. So like Jesse did, I'm just going to start off with a pretty simple chapter breakup. Very easy. You can pretty much divide it up into three different sections. Verses 1 to 8 is an encounter with angels. All right. Now, Abraham doesn't know that they're angels. Let's move this closer here. Verses 9 to 15 is Sarah's... Whoops, not Sass's. I like to say initial doubt. And those are the two sections that I'll cover tonight because I didn't get, well, there's not enough time to go into the third one. And then verses 16 to 33 is the impending judgment, etc., of Sodom. I have very poor writing, that's why I use a computer. All right, so that's a basic chapter. The first two points are the ones that we'll be trying to discuss and just go a little tonight. So Genesis chapter 18 opens with this statement. Yahweh appeared unto Abraham, that's the hymn there, in the plains of Mamre. Now, does anyone know where the plains of Mamre are? Where was that? Heard someone say it, and you were probably right. No. So the plains of Mamre, I'll draw you a brief little thing and then that sort of goes like that and that's in there. You can all sort of picture that as the land of Israel, really roughly. Mamre is roughly around there, or if you want a little context, it's a tiny bit south of Hebron. So Abraham's familiar with this place, he's been there a couple of times. That's roughly the plains of Mamre, also known as the Oaks of Mamre. They reckon gullible tourists get shown oak trees there and even nowadays, and they're like, oh, that's what Abraham saw, sort of thing. So that's the plains of Mamre, and that's where he's camping. Now, if you want a bit of context, the people that don't know where Sodom are, guess places are there, or like there somewhere. Okay, so just to give you a little idea of it. So that's where Abraham's being camped at. Now, he hasn't been there that long. He's been in the land here for roughly 10 years or so. In chapter 16, where he had Ishmael, he was 86. It's been 25 years since he was first called out of the land of Ur of the Chaldees. And he's been living in tents ever since. But he's traveled quite a bit in the land, and now he's here in the plains of Mamre. Now, we hear of a few people that have encounters with angels in the Bibles. But this one here is particularly special because Abraham is completely oblivious to the fact that they're angels. How do we know that? The way he speaks to them is one. There's actually a special word as well in the second verse of chapter 18. Spot on, Ryan. Say it a bit louder, sorry.
It says men.
The three men. Now, the word men there in verse 2 is the Hebrew word enoshim, E-N-O-S-H-I-M, which means weak mortal males. So from Abraham's point of view, these three men that are walking around outside, those are just normal males. He has no idea that they're actually angels, and that's how he views them. Also, if you want to whack it in your margin, and some people want to flick across there, Hebrews 13 verse 2. It's believed that this is talking about Abraham. Hebrews 13 verse 2 says, "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares." So it's guessed that that's talking about Abraham, about entertaining strangers unawares, or angels unawares. Hopefully you're not entertaining strangers unawares. Entertaining angels unawares. Okay, so Abraham here, we see, we'll read the first verse. It says that he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. He lift up his eyes, looked, and lo, three men stood by him. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself to the ground. So Abraham's here, he's sitting in the door of the tent. Some commentators believe that he was actually meditating, or, you know, thinking on God's words. I like to think personally that he was just trying to escape out of the sun for a while. You know that during the desert it gets pretty hot. So Abraham's trying to avoid the heat of the day, so he's staying inside in his tent. And it says in verse 2, we read that he looks up, sees these men doing what they're doing, and he thinks, "They're fine and there's no need for me to interrupt them." Now, is that what it says there? Not in the slightest. We see instead, from Abraham's point of view, more of like a prodigal son to father analogy. And how's this for service? He runs out to meet them, bows down before them, which for a 100-year-old man, that's one way to completely undo trying to keep cool during the heat of the day. So that in itself is a massive effort for Abraham to run out, meet these men and greet them. And I think it's particularly interesting for us to note that these men were complete strangers to Abraham, and yet this is the type of service that he's prepared to deliver to them. Now, there's a little exercise in the workbook on page 54 that's really handy, and it highlights all the times it describes how Abraham acts in verses 2 to 8. So if you've got a colour pencil, just jot them down, because this is how Abraham treats these servants. I don't actually address too many of the actual questions in the workbook, more just guide through them, so better be listening. All right, so if you've got a colour pencil, verse 2, Abraham ran to meet them. Verse 6, Abraham hastened back to the tent. Verse 6 again, he told Sarah, "Make ready quickly." Verse 7, Abraham ran to the herd. And then verse 7 again, he hastened to make it. That was it. Too late, Tom. Not write them up. No, I'm just kidding. Do you want them again?
Yeah.
So verse 6, he tells Sarah to make it quickly. Then in verse 7... Yeah, sorry. So in verse 6, first he hastens back to the tent. Then in verse 6, he tells Sarah to make the bread or the cakes quickly. Then in verse 7, Abraham runs to the herd. And then in verse 7 again, he hastens to make it. So basically, Abraham here isn't mucking around at all. He sees here an opportunity to serve and to do something good for these people, and he takes it. And he doesn't just take it, but he gives it his all. By this time, he still doesn't know that these people are angels, but because he's met them and spoke to them, he can probably tell that they're not your usual Canaanites. We know that when people met Peter during Christ's crucifixion, they knew because of his accent that he was from Galilee. The same sort of thing works here. Abraham would know that these people weren't your normal Canaanites, but he probably didn't know that they were angels just yet. So he rushes to help these people as much as he can. He says, "Look, stay with me. You can have some food. You can have some drink." And he even says, I think in verse 5 even says, "To comfort ye your hearts." So he's being very hospitable here. He's not just offering food and water, but he's saying, "Look, I've got a great home, a great environment, good atmosphere. Feel free to take advantage of it. Make yourselves hearty again before you go on your trip." Another thing that's probably interesting to note, and that we sort of get a hint that Abraham suspects something, is that he suggests that there's sort of a divine providence about them. In verse 5, he says, "Therefore ye come to your servant," in verse 5. So first of all, Abraham appears to them in a servant form. And secondly, he's saying that it's not by chance, but by God's providence that these people have come towards him. Now, there's another interesting thing that we can draw out from these verses, which I think we might overlook normally if we just read through it basically. I'm just going to read through verses 3 to 8, and I'm going to try and emphasize something. Abraham said, "My Lord, if I now have found favor in thy sight, pass not away, I pray thee, from thy servant. Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. And I will fetch a morsel of bread, and comfort ye your hearts. After that you shall pass on, therefore. For therefore are ye come to your servant." And they said, "So do as thou hast said." And Abraham hastened into the tent unto Sarah, and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes on the earth." And Abraham ran unto the herd, and fetched a calf, tender and good, and gave it unto a young man, and he hastened to dress it. And he, being Abraham, took butter and milk and the calf, which he had dressed, and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. So who picked up what I was trying to emphasize there? Abraham's doing it. What's interesting about that? Exactly. So a couple of chapters back, how many trained servants did he have when he went to get Lot back? 318. 318 trained servants we know he definitely had. And guess what? That was between 15 to 20 years ago. Goodness knows how many he's got now and how many people he has around him. And yet Abraham himself did all of this. And we can sort of think, brush it off as in, oh, that's, you know, good old Abraham. But that's real service and dedication, that the man that is going to inherit this land, that's received God's covenant, the verse before, that the seed that's going to save the world comes from him, is doing all this himself and not delegating it out to one of his servants. That's real service and you know what I mean. That's hospitality. That's the one. I need some more water. That's real hospitality. There you go, got it that time. Furthermore on that, he fetched a calf that was tender and good. So this isn't just like, you know, we'll whack some Skittles in a bowl for your local guests or something like that. This has now become a sacrificial meal. This has become a meal that's involved effort. You don't just sort of, who's done a roast? Brendan, I know you have. How long does it take to do a roast? 3 hours to make a good, classic roast. So this would take a lot of effort. You got to skin the calf, dress it, cook it. It takes a lot of time. And by killing the calf, he's now made this meal a sacrificial one. And I think the lesson from us here, or that we can draw from it, perhaps you can discuss it with your groups, is that good hospitality is sacrificial. You putting away what makes you comfortable and self-satisfying to yourself is what real hospitality is, and it's helping out your guests. Trying to make sure that the people that you are hosting are comfortable. That's the symbol of true hospitality. Also, I've got on a slightly side note, if you want to get really deep, this is the deepest I got because I just sort of had to deal with a meal. Isaiah chapter 7 verse 15 talks about butter and milk as being symbolic of the nourishment of the truth. So it's what the butter and the milk represents. If you wanted to go into that, you can. So the point being, and this is the point for theme number one, is that hospitality is self-sacrifice and service. Here we have a man considered one of the patriarchs of the Bible, the man that will inherit the land, and yet here he is running out in the hot of the day, cooking up a meal, completely unprepared for it, trying to serve these guests. What am I going for? It's about half my time. Cool. Is that half my time? And I suppose if you want a practical application from that, how much effort do we put into strangers? When we're at the week itself and we see someone perhaps sitting by themselves, or even if there are a couple of people that are sticking together that look like they don't really know anyone else, are we going to put in a bit of effort ourselves to try and make them feel better, more comfortable, a little self-sacrifice of our own to be more hospitable? Another good verse to whack in your margin, Romans chapter 12, verse 13. It's a great cross-reference, and it says, distributing to the necessity of saints given to hospitality. Now, the NIV translates that as share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. I think that pretty much covers all there is on that point. Yes, Jesse. Please make it easy.
In verse 8.
No.
Abraham says that he stood by them under the tree and they did eat.
Perfect.
What's that?
That's actually, you know, in fancy restaurants where people eat and the waiters stand right next to them?
Yeah.
Same thing. So Abraham here, I actually covered it, but I skipped over it because I had a lack of time. Abraham isn't just a servant, he actually waits on them in that regards, where he's standing by them, not eating himself, watching them eat, trying to cater for anything they might need. Anything else while I'm at it? I'm on a roll. If you've got any questions, shoot them now. So Isaiah 7 verse 15. And it talks about the nourishment of truth, nourishment of righteousness. So from that you can gather, like, by sharing the butter, it's sort of symbolic of them discussing the truth, which with angels would have been quite remarkable. 15, I think it was. Yes. I checked all the verses as well, so you won't be turning any up and going, what? Right, we'll move on to the next section then, verses 9 to 15, if there's no other questions. Nope. Okay, I like to call it Sarah's initial doubt. Now, the reason is because, I'll give you the reason, Hebrews chapter 11, just flick across with us there, if you would be so kind. Hebrews chapter 11, and if I can get... Jeremy, can you read verses 11 and 12 from there, please?
Through faith, also Sarah, the sacrifice of strength, receiving seed, and was delivered of a child when she was passed off, because she judged in faith the faithful who had promised. Therefore, sprang there even of one, and him as good as death, that many as the stars of the sky, multitude, and as the sand.
Thanks, Jeremy. Now, I'm going to make a brief assumption that everyone here knows Genesis chapter 18 and what happens in Genesis chapter 18. If anyone's unsure, then talking about Sarah having... So angels are talking with Abraham and say that Sarah's going to have a child. Sarah's listening behind a tent door so no one can see her, and she laughs within herself and doubts it. She says, you know, is Abraham going to have a child with me? Ha, ha, ha. And then they basically catch her out. And so it's a moment of temporary doubt for Sarah, where she looks at the frailty of her own body and Abraham's and says, there's no way I'm having a child. Or doesn't say there's no way, but she slightly doubts it. Now, Hebrews 11, verse 11 and 12 points out that it was through faith that Sarah had a son. Those are the words that it uses. So Sarah here can't be seen as weak, as a weak one, or one that lacks in faith, because she definitely has it, and she judged, it says that she judged him faithful who had promised. So she says, God, I trust you that I will have a son, and it's that faith that she develops over a couple of years that eventually leads to Isaac being born. And so just because she slips a bit in this chapter, or has her initial doubt, as I like to call it, over the next couple of months, because it's not even years, she'll develop a faith that's strong enough that God will judge her as righteous as he does with Abraham. So these strangers with Abraham, we'll just get back to the story, they're eating when one of them, who we presume was the spokesman for the other two, turns to Abraham and says, where is Sarah, your wife? Now, if Abraham didn't think that they weren't angels before that, he definitely knows they are now. The reason being is because they ask about Sarah. Her name was only changed from Sarai to Sarah in the last chapter, and that was, I think, I ran the numbers at home, that was maybe 3 months before tops, if you're looking at it chronologically, numerically. So it's definitely not years, it's weeks, possibly months before that Sarah's name has been changed. And when these angels ask about his wife, first of all, they knew he had a wife, but someone that prosperous probably would have in that time anyways, if not had multiple. They don't call her Sarai, they call her Sarah. Yeah, so some of the cogs might be turning in Abraham's head right about now. And we note that even Sarah here might think that there's particularly something strange going on with these strangers, because in verse 10, it's talking about how she's behind the curtain. Yeah, trying to find out about these strangers. So Abraham, you could say, is slightly taken back. It's a surprise response that he gives to him when he says, lo, she's in the tent. So that lo there is short for the, or another word for like, behold. So they ask Abraham about his wife Sarah, and he says, behold, she's in the tent. So Abraham's a little surprised, first at them addressing Sarah, his wife, and secondly, at her using his name, or Sarah's name, sorry. Now, because Sarah is standing behind a door, she hears all this, and how does Sarah react? She laughs. Yes, she laughs. Why does she laugh? She's very well stricken with age. How old is Sarah at this stage? 90 years old, so she's not exactly in the prime of her youth. So Sarah here thinks just for a moment, what? No way. Like, you can't imagine any of the elders at your ecclesia having kids at their age. Like, the kids would tear them apart, would just run circles around them. But God promises it to Abraham and Sarah here. Verse 11 and 12 of Genesis chapter 18, we'll just read it quickly, sort of gives us her reasoning. Abraham and Sarah were old and well stricken in age. It ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Therefore, Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? So number one, they're both old and stricken in years. Number two, Sarah has actually passed the stage in her life where she's able to have kids. Number three, I'll let you guess this one. What else about Sarah stopped her from having kids? She was barren. Thank you, Tom. She was actually barren. So even if she wanted to, she couldn't have had kids beforehand. And number four, are you still in Hebrews 11 by any chance? No, you're not. That's all right. Hebrews 11 verse 12, where it talks about Abraham, describes Abraham as good as dead. Kind of harsh, but that's how he is at this stage. Whether that's because of his age or because of his strength, we don't know. But Abraham himself at this stage may be past the point of having kids. So there's four main reasons why Sarah couldn't possibly have kids. And so we look at Sarah here and we sort of think like, oh, she drops in her faith, like she laughs within herself, she doubts God. But realistically, if you look at it from her point of view, it would have been quite a shock for her. You've got these complete strangers rocking up. You're preparing a quick lunch for them. You have no idea where they're from. You can't quite pick their accent, and they look a little different from the locals. And then suddenly they're telling you that you're going to have a kid. Like, that's pretty weird. So Sarah sort of laughs at the idea. Now, interesting enough, Abraham gets told that he's going to have a child back in Genesis 17. And does anyone know how he reacts? He laughs. Sorry, Tom. Yes, he laughs as well. Now, what's the difference? Very good, Sally. Yeah, so Abraham's laugh is a laugh of joy, a laugh of anticipation, or a faithful laugh. Can someone please look up Romans chapter 4, verses 19 to 22. So those are the verses that we know talk about Abraham and his faith and righteousness. Romans chapter 4, verses 19 to 22, and if the first person there can read it.
And being not weak in faith, he considered not his own body, now dead. When he was about 100 years old, neither yet the deadness of Sarah's womb. He staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but with strong faith, giving glory to God, and being fully persuaded that what he had promised, he was able also to perform. And therefore it was imputed to him for righteousness.
Thanks, Scott. So being fully persuaded is the words that it used there. In complete faith and conviction, Abraham knew God said it, it's gonna happen. So his laugh was a laugh of joyful anticipation, which is different to Sarah's one here. So it's a noticeable difference in their reactions in being told. Abraham is completely convinced that what God has said, so will he fulfill. Sarah, on the other hand, doubts it a little, but that doubt we'll see develops over the next year or so when Isaac is born. Now the angels, as they probably recognize at this stage, question Sarah and say, why did you laugh at this? Why'd you say this? Curiously enough, and I didn't actually notice or appreciate it, I should say, until I looked at it a bit further, Sarah hadn't actually laughed out loud. What's it say there? She laughed within herself. I also doubt from that context that when she said that stuff before, she didn't say it out loud to no one, but she said it in her mind and said it to herself as well. So now, if she didn't have any prior doubts, she's completely convinced now that these aren't just any strangers. Sarah laughs within her own head and thinks these things to herself, and then the angels literally read her mind and her thoughts. So she doesn't laugh out loud that everyone can hear her and they can be like, hey, why did you laugh at that sort of thing? She gets caught out by the angels at this stage and she knows it. Now she's then asked why she laughed, and they say, is anything too hard for Yahweh? We might read that and think that it's a little harsh on Sarah, but to a degree it really helped her over the next couple of years. So she couldn't have this child of promise unless she had complete and utter faith in God. And it's this statement that the angels give to her that is that I think lays the foundation of that faith that she'll develop over the next couple of years or so. The angels that say, is anything too hard for Yahweh? Now, Harry Whittaker says about the encounter, I like the way he said it, but I also sort of layman's termed it because he used a lot of big words as well. He says, was it for the sake of Abraham that Sarah escaped any further rebuke for her disbelief? So was it maybe because Abraham was there that the angels didn't push on? Or was it because Sarah's mind jumped quickly to the logical conclusion that had that the thing that was said, that with all God's... Sorry, I'll say that again. Or was it because Sarah's mind jumped quickly to the logical conclusion that had been said, in that with God, all things are possible? Does that make sense to everyone from in itself? So given these, Harry Whittaker here proposes that after the angels have said this thing, that with God, all things are possible, Sarah's mind and doubts have quickly gone, of course. Like, how can I doubt that? Everything is possible with God. I like to look at that point of view because I think that a lot of us can probably relate in one way or another, in that sometimes we have our own small doubts that lead us astray. And yet with constant reassurance and reaffirmation, we are convinced that God's way is the truth. And so that's the other real point, and I'll close on this, sorry. Right on time, good for me. And good for you. That's the other real point that we need to take home from this. Is anything too hard for Yahweh? You see, because we have times where we're very much like Sarah here as well. We have our own doubts and our own slip-ups, and sometimes we plummet off a cliff completely with our faith. But it's not about how badly we fall, like even Sarah's small slip here, but it's whether our faith in God can pull us back up. So Sarah here slips a tiny bit, but in two chapters, we'll read later on how Abraham makes the very same mistake that nearly cost him his life a while ago. So if there's that one thing that we can take from here and that we can apply to our own lives and hopefully share with our groups, it's that no matter how many times we fall, it's the amount of times we get back up that's what God's looking for. It's a rhetorical question that the angels give to Sarah. Is anything too hard for Yahweh? And we know that the answer is no. As a final nice little thing to put into your margins, Luke chapter 18 verse 27 sums it up perfectly. It says, Jesus said to them that were listening, "The things which are impossible to men are possible with God." Thanks, Tom. Oh, any questions?
I just can't let this one go, sorry. You might just want to jot this down too. Luke 1, Mary, who is a virgin, actually says to God, "God, how am I going to have a child? I'm a virgin." And God says, he said, "Well, look at your cousin Elizabeth," in verse 36 of chapter 1, "who is old and barren, exactly the same as Sarah." And I actually reckon that God is saying, think about Elizabeth, but also go right back to that original scene when Sarah was barren and old, and think about that too, because the next words of the angel are this: "For with God nothing shall be impossible." It's pretty much the exact same thing.
All right. Thank you, brothers, Jesse and Eden, for tonight.